Good evening. Hello, and welcome to Tate Modern. I'm Stuart Comer, curator of film here, and it's a great pleasure to welcome you to the world premiere of Stephen Prina's new film, The Way He Always Wanted It To. There'll be a reference to where the title comes from at the end of the film, and I don't want to go into it quite yet, but I'm sure it will come up in the conversation that Stephen and I will have afterwards. Prina, basically, I think many of you know, emerged as a student at CalArts, a student of sort of the first generation of institutional critique artists such as Michael Asher, Douglas Hubler, and John Baldessari. And then he developed into perhaps one of the most interesting links, I think, between that particular generation of artists and a generation of artists in the 90s who developed more dispersed practices, practices that involved design, such as Jorge Pardo, video installations, such as Diana Theder, or textual practices, such as Francis Stark. But Prina's own work, first and foremost, I think came to attention largely in the context of the 1980s and discourses around appropriation and, again, a rethinking of things like institutional critique and site specificity. About 8 years ago, he produced his first film, which was, in fact, a commission from the Getty Museum and engaged quite directly with these histories of the institution and the critique therein. Having taught a number of iconic classes at the Art Center College of Art and Design in Pasadena on filmmakers such as Chantal Ackerman, Fassbinder, and many other European filmmakers, I think it's quite appropriate in many ways that he has chosen film as his medium most recently, although he continues to work in a very expanded mode, again, something we will get into later. It's very difficult to locate Prina's practice, and it has eluded many people for quite some time, although I think there have been a few major articles. Certainly Tom Hollert's piece on Prina's first film, which was published in Art Forum, I think really began to articulate and grapple with the complexities in this work. And I think this new film really is an incredible achievement. It really looks at the history of projects like We Represent Ourselves to the World, which engages with the problem of photography and representation and applies it to the problem of representing architecture or what a body of work like that of Bruce Goff's could represent beyond architecture. So I'll leave my marks there for the moment, but it's a huge pleasure to welcome Stephen to London. Please do stick around for the conversation afterwards because he's extremely eloquent and I'm sure will add greatly to your understanding of the film. I should mention also we will be screening Vinyl 2, his first film after the new film, which is, again, the film shot at the Getty Museum. So again, please welcome Stephen Prina.
Good evening. I wanted to thank Stuart for inviting me here for the premiere of this film. I don't want to say very much before the screening. We are going to see the most recent film first, basically for technical efficacy, because it's 35 millimeter, and then we'll have a short gap between, very short, where I'll try to arrange some language in the vicinity of the gap. And then we'll immediately see the film Vinyl 2 after that in 16 millimeter. Maybe one thing I could say about this film that we're seeing has something to do with its point of departure. I was in Chicago, Illinois in 2002. I was making a collaborative work with Galen Gerber, and we were installing it at the Art Institute of Chicago, and it was in the dead of winter. It was in January. Snow was everywhere. I think it was about, 0 degrees, and that's Fahrenheit. And we had Sunday off, and Galen understands that I have an interest in architecture. I usually describe myself as being a failed architect, but we took the day to drive to see the Farnsworth House by Mies, and we had a little extra time after, and we drove to see the Ford House in Aurora, Illinois, and Sidney Robinson lives there, and he was very gracious, and he invited us into the home to see it. And as soon as I walked in the door, I realized that I had fundamentally misunderstood the architecture of Bruce Goff. I had looked at his work. I had studied him a little bit. I basically respected him, but I thought it was basically not my cup of tea. But then I realized that there was something missing in my understanding of him. And in many respects, that's the motor for this project. And being the inveterate formalist that I am, I thought that the house was screaming out for semicircular tracking shots. And from there, I thought perhaps it might be, it would behoove me to at least adopt the mantle of the quasi-scholar and do some research into Goff. And the Bruce Goff archives are held at the library at the Art Institute of Chicago, and they were very gracious into welcoming me into the archive, into the library, and I spent a long time doing research there, where I discovered that Goff was not only an architect of note, but he had also been a very serious composer of music until he turned 30, where he had to make the decision to make a choice, because there were fewer great modern architects than there were modern composers, and he thought he would have a better shot at it, is what he said. You know, at least I'm paraphrasing. So that began a certain kind of expedition into the archive, and then I found a variety of other elements that in an uncanny way seemed to touch base with some, I guess, for want of a better term, would be autobiographical elements. So at this point, maybe we should see the film, and then, as I mentioned, we'll have a very short, I'll have a little discussion between the films, just for the changeover when they have the 16mm film ready to screen, and then we can have a more extended conversation after. Thank you very much for coming. thank you. And now while they're making the changeover to 16, perhaps I could say a few things about the conditions under which Vinyl 2, the next film we'll see, were made. I was invited to participate in an exhibition entitled Departures, 11 Artists at the Getty. I think that was the title of the show. And it was the first time that the Getty Museum in Los Angeles had attempted to make a contemporary exhibition with living artists. And all of the artists who were asked are from Southern California. Judy Fiskin, John Baldessare, Adrian Sachs, a variety of others. And I was a little bit suspicious when I first received the invitation because I thought it was one of those situations, again, where the institution asks, please, dear sir, will you kindly come and deconstruct our museum for us? So I'm very interested in the machinations of museum and institutions, but I'm a little bit hesitant when it seems to be so automatically folded into the program. But they did leave it very open, and they said, you know, the artist could respond to the Getty or artworks at the Getty or the idea of the museum or the idea of a collection or anything like that. So at one point I thought perhaps there might be something that I could do within the within this kind of proposition. And the film that you're about to see will use two of the galleries at the Getty as ready-made sets. And one of the conditions that encouraged them to agree to this project, a film being made in their galleries. Museums get very skittish when you say, oh yes, I want to shoot a film in your galleries and bring in all these huge lights and a crew, and they're always afraid that, you know, a huge lamp is going to fall over through the middle of their Rembrandt or something. So I assured them that we wanted to make the film with only available light that would be available in the galleries. And these two galleries have skylights that have mechanized louvers, but during the entire shoot there was the lighting meister from the Getty there with his light meter, and he was warning that if there was ever a moment when the lumens reached over a certain level, they would have to close the louvers a little bit. But that didn't actually happen. We used a similar kind of logic with the film that you just saw, the way he always wanted it to, where we only used available light at the Ford House in Aurora. So it either had to be the January winter light coming in through the vast windows obstructed with the jungle, or, for instance, indirect lighting that I believe is neon tubing and the incandescent lights that were in the house. And let's see, what else could I say? I didn't know how long this gap is going to be. The music that I've written for the next film, Vinyl 2, it came out of an impulse. In some respects, it came out of a quote that David Grubbs at least attributes to me, where I had said at one point, for me in music, there are only two things that exist: love songs and drones. And for those of you who went to My Bloody Valentine last night, you would, I think, be able to understand that in some capacity. And this is my attempt to address a similar kind of condition. Like what happens when you bring a materialist operation on a musical instrument together with the conventional structures of a pop song, a love song, a song about love, sex, and death. Okay, they're giving me the sign, so we're ready to see this film. So we'll have the Q&A, or whatever we call it these days, after the film. Thank you.
A candle. Great. Okay, so I'd like to open it up to the audience soon, but I just want to kind of map out a few issues just to get going, because there's a lot of territory we can cover tonight. But I think to start off, I'd like to address Bruce Goff, who's the subject, or his house that he designed in Aurora, Illinois, as the subject of the first film. For those of you who weren't here earlier today, there was a panel discussion featuring architectural historians and architects such as Charles Jenks, Sidney Robinson, who actually owns and lives in the house currently, John Sargent, and others. And it was really fascinating. I think it broke open Goff as a sort of a meta figure in a way, who is not just an sort of underknown and underrecognized architect, but again, as the word keeps coming up today and this week, polymath. He was a musician, a composer, a painter. He did a lot of different things and really did see organic relationships between all these media, but finally, in the end, was not forced, but chose to focus primarily on architecture, or at least that's certainly what he's become best known for. Preena, clearly, for those of you who do know his work, is similarly a polymath, and his work has followed a number of different strands, and works tend to cannibalize other works, and so you can almost lose your bearings at times, but then he always puts up very interesting signposts to lead along the way. But I guess maybe could you talk a little more, I mean, you introduced by discussing how you sort of discovered the house, but in the lecture today you mentioned also the problem of photographing Goff, the problem of representing his buildings, and how that had led you to misunderstand it. Now that we're in an era where magazines like Wallpaper, Fashion Magazine, others have fetishized modernist architecture to a really frightening degree, actually. And in a way, you're trying to kind of, I think, maybe establish a different relationship to representing that kind of architecture.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I would like to think that the subject of that film, in part, is addressing a misunderstanding. So, and I was able to, and I only came to that after I had worked on the film for a while. So I was trying to come to terms with how I had thought that I had an understanding of Goff, and then I realized that something was amiss. And as I mentioned earlier today, I attribute it to early 1950s color photography, and the way in which that was used in magazines to represent, or even in books, to represent Goff's work. And it seemed to create an imbalance in Goff's work that when you actually experience one of his structures or buildings, that is not the imbalance that one encounters. So things like his idiosyncratic materials start to float to the surface in the photographs, where when you actually walk into the homes, yes, they are articulated, and material detailing is very important, but everything seems to have kind of a place. It resides, it creates a surface on the interior of the space. And so someone asked me a question earlier today before having seen the film, and said, you know, well, is there going to be a moment when the camera looks up into the top of the dome where all of the red Quonset hut ribs kind of fall back upon themselves and issue out from the center, and then there's a spire and an oculus skylight. And I said, well, no, I didn't film that for my film. And I actually hadn't even considered it. I had kind of, you know, it had never seemed to have a place within the logic that I wanted to exercise for the house. But having said that, I think that is the iconic image of that house. It's the image that you would use here for publicity. I mean, especially since I couldn't, you know, provide you with film still grabs in time. But that is how the house is known. And even though it was not my intention to negate that in the house, the choreography that was designed and deployed for the house, both in terms of camera movement and in terms of the musical score that had been developed for it, did not accommodate that element of the house, probably its most recognizable part of it. And so I guess I wanted to reprioritize the way in which the elements that have heretofore come to represent the house. I think that only came later, though. I mean, I kept thinking about cutting slices through the house in different ways and showing different fragments of it. And some of the fragments seem familiar to a fragment that you may have already seen in the house, but there's no exact repetition in the film in any way, in terms of shots or in terms of the music. There are motifs that sound familiar, but there's never any exact repetition.
And then, I mean, you spoke earlier about how it was screaming out for certain tracking shots, but I mean, the camera work is very specific, very controlled, very tight, all in close-up. Maybe could you talk a bit about that? And I also just, I mean, I want to get a little bit onto Robert Bresson as well, whose work you've referred to in other works and you've also written about. And I think in some ways this does invoke his cinematography. And I wonder if you could talk about that a bit.
Maybe you'll have to talk about that.
Okay.
So what was the first question?
Tracking shots.
Oh, yeah.
Camera work.
I mean, I tried to make the tracking shots as controlled as possible, as controlled as is technically possible at this moment in history. So we used a motion-controlled rig, so the camera always moves along one track that was laid in the house, and it's more or less a 240-degree arc, and the camera always moves along that, and it is controlled by a computer. So the rate of speed and where you know the amount of time it takes to go from point A to point B in that arc. So that is one constant in the film. The camera never leaves that until the last shot when it's handheld, when this behemoth 55-pound camera is hoisted on little David Hollander's shoulder and he walks it out into the snow. But then having said that, all the other variables that are established are customized in some way. So it almost becomes a narrative of the possibility of customizing the technical over the arc of the film, because it seems as though, yes, the camera is always going to move along this arc. It starts at eye level, the next shot is a lower level, the next shot is a higher level, and then it returns to eye level. At the apex, the camera is always making a 240-degree pan, or so it seems. The first few are like that, and then there's one that is truncated, and it allows for a symmetrical doubling. The third shot, the camera is facing that black anthracite coal wall, and it's doing it in such a way that it is traveling along its arc, and one of the results of that is actually flattens it out in terms of film space, that if you only saw that scene, you would think you're looking at a flat wall, but you all have already recognized the fact that it is, in fact, not flat at all. And then the next shot is 180 degrees from that, looking. It's a high shot looking up onto the raised platform, which is the artist's studio. It was Ruth Ford's studio. It's Sydney's drafting room. I think that's where you have your drafting table and your drafting lights. And so it made that kind of possibility of symmetry. And then. All of these kind of metrical controls, even though they are numerically controlled, spin off into a different kind of narrative structure after that. Because it goes, then the next pan is shorter than it should be, is shorter than it should be, then the last pan is longer than it should be, and then it's as though the camera is released from this motion control and goes out into the yard.
Before we get onto the music, too, I think since you're talking about the space of the actual house, again, in the afternoon discussion, something about the way in which Goff would engage with the private lives of his clients and really allow the architecture and their own lives to kind of develop together in a very organic fashion. Maybe you could talk about the element of biography in this, because I think it involves not one but many biographies, in a sense.
And I think that after a certain point, I realized that my autobiography was in there somehow, not to make too huge point of it, but I didn't know anything about Goff no anecdotes or no biographical information until I had visited the house. And then when I started doing research, I came to know that he was a painter, and he continued painting during his entire life. I believe that there are 600 paintings that are held by the Art Institute of Chicago. I don't know how many of those have ever been exhibited, but they're there for the future. And then he was a very serious composer. As far as I'm concerned, he was a very serious composer until he turned 30, at which point he needed to make a decision. He decided that there were fewer great modern architects than there were great modern composers, and maybe he would have a better shot at it if he focused upon architecture. But at that moment when I detected that, I thought, I thought that this was, me going off into this totally new territory. And, do we ever actually embark into a totally new territory? Because I had done other projects in the past. For instance, the first project that I had used this title for, that's why it's two, is The Way He Always Wanted It. It's a score for a musical installation. I had designed it in 1979. It's never been realized. And it's for 1,082 loudspeakers arranged in six circles on the floor, and they're sounding the six little piano pieces of Arnold Schoenberg in the time it takes Glenn Gould to play each of the six. So it takes less than 6 minutes to play all six of them. But Schoenberg occupied a similar kind of position in that he took painting very seriously, and Kandinsky had included reproductions of Schoenberg paintings in the Der Blaureiter Almanac. But at one point, Schoenberg realized that if he was going to truly be taken seriously in music, he had to focus upon that and present himself as exclusively dedicated to that. I would like to think that we occupy a different historical moment now, and there are different historical options for artists who work in this. You're using the term polymathics, Tony Conrad and many others this week.
And then maybe, again, if you could talk about the score, including the lyrics, which, again, have a biographical component. And, I mean, you spoke earlier today a little bit about the structure of the music, which is quite interesting. Mm-hmm.
Maybe before I do that, it was kind of strange to keep going back to Aurora, Illinois, which is about 45 minutes outside of Chicago. And I was born in a small town in central Illinois, Galesburg, Illinois. That's about 3.5 hour drive from Chicago. And once I got out of there, I thought I would never return. It's like, okay, I'm in Los Angeles now, and I don't need to think about the Midwest. I don't need to think about the small town life. And it's very strange how that comes back as a constitution of your subjectivity, no matter if you tried to actively suppress it or if it's repressed or whatever. And so it was strange to then land in Aurora on the plains of Illinois in the dead of winter in January, thinking, like, what am I doing here making a movie? And even though I don't think that the word enters into any of the language of the archive, I think it's clear to me that Bruce Goff was homosexual. And in fact, that was one of the reasons why he lost his job at the University of Oklahoma. And it seemed like a kind of sting operation that maybe was set up, and he lost his position. So I'm thinking, there's this kind of situation, and then there are all these letters in the archive between Richard Sanjul. Well, actually, they're all from Richard Sanjul, or most of them. And there seemed to be this very intimate relationship between Richard Sanjul and Bruce Goff. But they didn't use the same kind of language that perhaps we might use today. And so I don't even want to kind of jump to conclusions and say, give it a name, the love that has a name. But anyway, but there seemed to be at least a reciprocal care and a demonstration of affection. And I thought, this gives me the moment to create another kind of fissure in the surface of this film. I think that that's how it comes to be that I go to great lengths to set up these extremely controlled situations with the camera, for instance, so that I can then mobilize an element that seems to at least attempt to derail that or collide with it in some way. There's a little bit of a difficulty in it being contained within that structure. And then I become the conduit because I'm the one singing in the film. So what does that make me? What kind of subject am I if I'm singing words from Richard Sanjul's letters to Bruce Gough, and I'm singing them in the house? And the house was built just a few years after Sanjul's untimely death of a brain injury, and that it sundered that relationship.
And if you could talk just a little further about the notational structure as well.
Of the music?
Yes.
That's a little bit more complicated to talk about because there are extensive holdings in the Bruce Gough archives at the Art Institute in Chicago of his music. So certain of the music manuscripts are complete and final. They're in their finalized form. Some of these compositions had been performed live in concert, and Bruce Gough had attended these concerts. It's my understanding that some of these compositions had never been performed live, so they only exist on paper. But then some of them were like a little sketch on the back of an envelope, and or metrically figuring out what happens if you have opposing scales or melodies, and making diamond shapes on music paper. And so I just tried to collect as much of this stuff as possible. And then another very valuable research tool was in 1995 there was a retrospective of the work of Bruce Gough at the Art Institute, and I didn't see that exhibition, but at the time before that time they had discovered piano player roles, and so Bruce Gough had written for player piano by making holes in a player piano role and making his compositions that way. And for the 95 retrospective, they were played through a player piano and a DVD was made. And so I used much of that also as source material. So I would notate that by ear. Some of the compositions that were a little bit too complicated for me to play, I hired a pianist to input them into my computer. So I took it all to be source material. And then the kind of hard work began because I wanted to make the score do things that perhaps Gough would not make this music do. Like for instance, I was taking little bits of player piano snippets and something from like a very serious kind of noisy piano work, and then shoehorning it into the form of a conventional pop song, which is the third movement. I mean, I'm drawing from about 8 different sources, putting things in different keys, indicating things to be played at different tempi, orchestrating it for a different ensemble, all in a way to kind of tame it and allow it to function within the convention of a pop song. But if you would actually look at the score, it's very, very complicated. It's not 4-4. And so all of those kinds of hesitations in it are very particularly notated, and they've all been lifted from the Gough. And even some of the melodies had been transcribed. Some of the melodies, like the intro melody to that song, I've written that as a response to the Gough. But there are actually very few elements, or the scalar cello part at the end of the pop song, that's a response to all this Gough interweaving. But then sometimes I would simply be inspired by something that he had written. And it seemed to me that I don't have any evidence of this. And, you know, I'm not a real scholar, so it doesn't make any difference. You know, I'm an artist, and we can, like, abuse any kind of materials that we get our hands on. But it seems to me that he was influenced by Henry Cowell. And, you know, Henry Cowell had developed all sorts of extended piano techniques. And so Gough used cluster chords. You know, I don't know if everyone is familiar with that, but, you know, using a fist on a piano to play a chord, or using a block of wood to play many, many keys at one time. And so at the end of the pop song, where there had been very articulated chords, the pianist starts using his fists Actually, that's what I indicated, and he actually played them all the notes that you were supposed to play with it. But anyway, it gave that very, very slightly thicker kind of congested tone. I was talking to Sydney earlier about one of the player piano excerpts, because there were quite a few of them, and most of them were fully realized player piano compositions. And by the way, Goff was writing for player piano decades before Colin Mancaro, and I don't know if he even knew if one knew the other. So you don't know either, do you? So this was kind of like experimenting with. One could consider it to be kind of like a proto-synthesizer, you know, a programmable mechanical keyboard instrument very, very early, and applying modern music techniques to it. But there was one example where it's one single melody that was programmed for player piano, and why did he do that? It's not as though he was writing a sketch down just to remember a melody. It's quite a long melody. Maybe, you know, he charted out the melody first on the player piano roll with the intention of going back and, you know, cutting more holes, you know, so that it would become orchestrated. But I was very drawn to this melody, and it seemed as though it was lonely to me too. Anyway, but and it also may have seemed that, and this may be me producing an imaginary narrative, but I thought that, well, maybe this was written at the moment that he decided that he had to surrender any kind of allegiance to composition. I thought, well, I'm going to pick this up, and I'm going to treat it as though it's the tone row in a dodecaphonic composition. And so that's what happens with the marimba vibraphone duet. And then it's kind of simplified and put back into a more tonal structure in the last movement. When I say dodecaphonic system, I'm really, it's like a fake version of that. I'm not scrupulously it's like someone who had read a short essay about Schoenberg and heard one thing and thought, oh, I can do that. So it's kind of like the amateur's version of what using 12-tone would be. Someone asked me earlier about there was a lot of discussion earlier about Claude Debussy, and Goff often cited Debussy as his artistic model, even before he would cite Frank Lloyd Wright in architecture, and primarily because Debussy he considered to be an uncompromising artist, and that was, I think, a very important aspect to Goff. But one thing that I tried to achieve in the score that I assembled, arranged, composed, whatever word you want to use, is that it seems to start in one period or being made out of the materials of one period, and then it moves into a slightly later period, and then it segues into pop music, and then it goes into this kind of an approximation of 12-tone, and then it goes into something that would not be out of place in a minimal music concert, I think. The first movement, I use a 22-second fragment of a... Well, actually, it's only a fragment exists. It looks like he just stopped writing it. And it sounds very much like Ravel or Debussy or something like that. And it's only 22 seconds long, and I repeated it a number of times and applied a Lucas Foss compositional technique. I call it Lucas Foss because I learned the technique through listening to Lucas Foss, so it may have existed previous to that. But where the composition is realized through removing notes. So I had this, I think it's repeated 6 times, and I removed the most sounded notes at first, so that keeps it roaming as much as possible because it has been released from a tonic center. And so it's only gradually that the harmonic structure is assembled and it starts to shape it into something that has a tonal center, and then at the very last pass, you get the pedal tone over and over and over again that instantiates this is what the key of this work is. And then the second movement is using that exact same score, but it has been scored for piano trio with cello and oboe. And there have been a few alterations to it, but basically that's the underlying structure. But the alterations to it by introducing the cello part, the oboe part, and then this kind of thicker polyphonic section that the piano plays, it starts to sound not so much like Debussy and Ravel. It starts to sound more, it has the reminiscences of Stravinsky or even, you know, Perrade-era Erik Satie. So what I was attempting to demonstrate there is that this musical text is very fragile, and so it seems to align itself with certain kinds of references when it's deployed at one point, and then with these slight shifts in it, it seems to address a different kind of historical legacy.
And then in terms of historical legacies, just to try to connect it with maybe one last question before we open it up, but to your previous work. I mean, again, I was just reading through this again. It's a fantastic publication, We Represent Ourselves to the World, which documents a specific project. What year did you do the Max Hetzler project?
1991.
It began, and then it continues to evolve in some ways, I guess, through other projects? I mean, how, because you have...
Well, I've reinstalled it, but it always takes the exact configuration of its original installation in Cologne in 1991.
But it very much is dealing with this idea of archives, photography within the archive, and architecture, and institutional architecture in particular. But in this project, you've gone back to the archive again. In this case, not a commercial gallery archive, but an artist or an architect's archive. But rather than, again, do a sort of installation-based practice in which you're using maybe some classic tropes of conceptual art, you're limiting it to one medium, film, which, of course, has been invoked as a Gesamtkunstwerk. But, I mean, why have you decided to limit yourself in that way? And how would you connect this, again, to earlier projects?
The limit to film?
Or yes, to film.
I think I would approach that question from a different direction in that I had resisted making films for many years. I taught, as you mentioned, I had taught film history classes for a very long time from, you mentioned, you know, like a semester on Chantal Ackerman or Godard or films of Keanu Reeves in 1994, pre-Speed, thank you very much. I don't, maybe it was a weak moment with this invitation from the Getty, because, especially invoking the term Gesamtkunstwerk, the total artwork, I had been very influenced by Theodor Adorno's writing on Wagner, in Search of Wagner, where, in fact, I think that, you know, a subtitle of that book could be a systematic dismantling of the Gesamtkunstwerk. And I think because I, from a very early age, I was very involved in visual art and in music, it was always taken for granted that I would want to find a way to bring those together and to synthesize them. And the result would be the Gesamtkunstwerk. And actually reading the Adorno critique of Wagner allowed me a different way. And so I thought, well, I don't have to do that. And it may not come down to a bifurcated kind of practice that needs to be synthesized, but and it may not come down to visual art and music, because you know, maybe one could also see that broadening with other kinds of preoccupations, like, you know, language, or not just thinking about it in terms of visual art, but the difference between the discipline of photography and the discipline of painting. So, for instance, when I would make a drawing project, I would want to really dig my heels into the discipline of drawing, recognizing the limits of that discipline and seeing what I could do within that, and also kind of straining at the barriers of it. And then I would move on and do a photography project with the same kind of same thing in mind. And sometimes I would attempt to manage painting, photography, language, and music, different aspects of an overall project, but each one kept discrete. And I think that it simply, you know, maybe I'm just slow. It took me a while to figure out an acceptable way for me to work in the most synthetic art form of the 20th century, being film. And so I thought that, you know, maybe I could finally figure out a way to do this where it wouldn't simply become the the all-encompassing project, that there would always be the other trails leading off from it. If that makes any sense.
So why don't we lead off into the audience now? We haven't really gotten onto Vinyl 2 yet, so I don't know if anyone has questions about that film in particular, but does anyone have any questions in general? If you could just wait for the microphone, Gene, thank you.
You mentioned Bresson, and you said you were going to touch on it, and I just wondered if you could say something about Bresson in relation to your practice. Mm-hmm. And you ended your talk on love, sex, and death from the podium, from the lectern.
Would you want to say something about Bresson?
I could do. I'm just trying to remember, because you wrote, I mean, again, you should maybe talk a little bit about The Devil, probably, mm-hmm. and its importance to other projects that you've done, but I think I remember you wrote a piece in art form quite a long time ago about Bresson, and specifically his use of gesture, his use of the body, mm-hmm. And again, the way he crops things and focuses on feet or on hands or on certain gestures, mm-hmm. and I think you can kind of see evidence of that in the way that bodies and, you know, especially the workers on the set are, in a sense, kind of fragmented as much as the architecture in this.
Mm-hmm. By way of anecdote, the first time that I have seen the entire film well projected was this afternoon, because we did a screening at Panavision in Hollywood a few weeks ago, and the projectionist freaked out. I said, well, heads are cut off. Like, and they were trying to, reframe it in such a way so I could, recapture the head, and I hadn't even thought to say anything about that, because I didn't go in thinking, I'm going to crop heads out of this film. It had nothing to do with that. It had to do, again, with these discrete areas of choreography. I knew what the camera was going to do. I knew that all the musicians were going to be in the space. I definitely knew the piano was going to be in that place, because that's where Bruce Goff has drawn the baby grand piano on the original floor plans. But I had and I knew that the cello and oboe, I wanted them in the sunken area, which is the kitchen area, basically. And then the marimba and vibraphone on the raised area, and I would be located where I was. But it wasn't about coming in there with the idea that I want this kind of image to be the result. I mean, I didn't know that I would be cropped from the bottom of my lip down. That was a result of these different things these different requirements coming together. And so that's where I think that there's a certain kind of serendipity of effect. So I'm not so interested in the goal of a particular image, but satisfying these different requirements, the requirements of spatializing the music, using this particular location, trying to come up with camera moves that respond to that, that rearticulate that, but in a semi-autonomous manner. And then this is what the result of it is. But with the Bresson, I have had a long, extended relationship with the work of Bresson in different ways. I mean, I offered a standard semester of the films of Bresson. But then I also did this other project called The Devil Probably Times 11 Plus 1. And I showed the film The Devil Probably from 1977 11 weeks in a row in my class in the theater. And every week there was a different reading assignment, and so we would discuss the film in a different way every week. And the plus one part is that I showed The Third Generation by Fassbinder, where in the opening credit sequence of that film, the last scene from The Devil Probably is on the video monitor, and Hanna Shigula is playing the part of a secretary in a high-rise office building in Frankfurt. But I always took that as being a very overt gesture by Fassbinder saying, Bresson's film is a preface to my film. We're talking about the distance between, let's say, 77 or 78 and 68, and the irretrievable politics and political attitude of that period. And then I had used a scene from The Devil Probably as visual material in a 35-panel photographic work with computer-cut vinyl. So,
and lyrics as well.
Oh, right, because all the subtitles from those frame enlargements became the lyrics for a song. I have a
a pop CD entitled Push Comes to Love, and it's on Drag City Records, and the song The Devil Problem was on that. So it was I became very fixated upon that because I wanted there to be this very concrete visual / textual trace that was being woven in and out of all these different projects, and each time it would appear, these, for instance, the lyrics would appear, or these words would appear, they would have a different kind of weight. And I think the way in which they were framed, it would encourage a very different kind of interpretation of the very exact same materials. But at that moment, I was also not afraid to say that, you know, being a teacher is part of my production as an artist, not something that stands apart from it. And I wanted to do something explicit about that. You know, I'd done these classes on Bresson, so here it is in this artwork. And then it trickled into this other project as well. But to say something about, you know, just the way in which Bresson uses the body, exercises the body, and I mean, he called the people in his films models, and save for, I think, one person, they were all non-professional actors, because he couldn't get the right kind of performances from professional actors, and I believe he only used one actor in two different roles in two different films, which could be seen as being, you know, the work of a sadist, like, I've used you and now I discard you, but still there was that idea that that these bodies were cast for one role and one role only, and then he would rehearse these models over and over again. They would have to go through these gestures hundreds of times, so that it wouldn't look spontaneous, it wouldn't look mundane, but it wouldn't look. It was beyond rehearsed. It was as though the gestures would be in the body and emanating from the body, and I don't think bodies look like that in any other film but Bresson. And so he was able to, you know, really... I think it's all about the technique of the body. The body is a technique, and that there's a technical aspect of the body. And he was able to find a way to give form to that in art.
Any other questions? Maybe we should just quickly talk about Vinyl 2 as well.
Okay.
And again, maybe address a little bit again this legacy of institutional critique to which you've been tied many times, and maybe how you feel about that legacy now in 2008, especially having made a second film that I think you could say is a companion piece to the first film, but mm-hmm. they're radically different in other ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, the idea of... I mean, it's always troubling to even come up with, you know, nomenclature like institutional critique, because then people want to say, well, here are all the components to it, and this is how it works, and, you know, we know how to do that, and then we move on. It's at the very moment when something is named, that's the very moment that it can be considered historically obsolete. And I always thought that, you know, if there were possibilities with institutional critique, that it would be an ongoing project, that one would need to arrive at different subjects, different materials, different strategies. I'm still interested in, you know, how is it that we even come to be arranged in this room tonight in the way that we are? We're sitting on this, you know, we're kind of talking to each other, we're kind of acting like we're having a conversation here with you, but we're not really. We're making eye contact from time to time. I'm interested in those kinds of things. I'm interested in how it's even possible for me to show a film like this in this venue. So I think that those are non-trivial concerns. But how does one find a way... You know, at the very moment that you think you understand that, how do you problematize your relationship to all of the components so that you actually learn something more from that territory that you're trying to explore? So...
In the past, when you've shown films, or at least the first two times I saw Vinyl 2, the first was at the Getty, of course, the second time was at Qubit here in London when David Bessel was curating there. And in each instance, there was an exhibition or, you know, something hung on the wall as a component in separate from but related to the screening. Mm-hmm. So at the Getty, I believe you had a poster for the film that was installed in the gallery.
Two photographs.
And then you had an exhibition at Cubitt in conjunction with the screening of the film.
Of those photographs.
Right.
And here, I mean, it seemed there was the symposium, the Bruskoff symposium was the exhibition. I thought it was very interesting to be able to schedule two different screenings, you know, one within, you know, with Charles Jenks giving the keynote address, and then one where we're talking about film, we're looking at film and seeing these two films that I've made. Two very different kinds of presentations, I think. I mean, to the point where I think that the artworks are fundamentally different, one presentation to the next.
And maybe you should also just talk about the show that opens next month in Baden-Baden, in which you'll screen the film again, and how it relates. Again, you don't really believe, or at least you would challenge, the notion of a conventional retrospective, so maybe you could talk a little bit.
I don't want no retrospective. To quote Ed Ruscha. But say, I'm not interested in embracing negation as a security blanket, you know. So I could say, oh, I don't want a retrospective. Oh no, I don't want to do a show at your institution. You know, but, you know, we'll have to come up with some kind of alternative to that. So, you know, I have the opportunity to make an exhibition in a very beautiful exhibition house. There are 9 rooms, and so how does an artist deal with the challenge and pressure of that? And one of the coordinates that I built into that is that I don't want it to read as a retrospective, but I don't want it all to be like the fetish of the new, like everything is made last week by my whatever, my 3,000 assistants or something that are working like little elves, which I don't have, by the way. But so it will be an exhibition that shows work from 1987 to the present. In fact, one work isn't even finished for that show, and it opens July 18th. But What I was trying to treat this, and it will undoubtedly be seen as a survey, but I'd like it also to be a commingling of a variety of different essays. And so I've tried to select different kinds of works that will tease out different kinds of elements, and that so across the overall exhibition plan, one could trace it in a certain way of like a relay effect from one work to another to another. But if you would start with another kind of work, maybe there would be a different kind of thread to follow through the exhibition. I mean, this is the attempt. We'll see if it works.
And then you mentioned a moment ago, I mean, your sort of views on your role as a pedagogical figure. Mm-hmm. You know, you really wanted to situate your teaching, you know, within your broader practice. And I suppose, sorry, again, the layering of that within what is built or designed to be a pedagogical institution, like Tate Modern, in which our function is to essentially interpret our collection, interpret mm-hmm. the works mm-hmm. displayed therein. There's been a lot of headlines about art schools for the last several years. It's been going mm-hmm. on for quite a while now, and I think, in a way, perhaps you were complicit within that as one of the major figures teaching in Los mm-hmm. Angeles. But I guess, where do you see that role of pedagogy now? And in the sense that people in this room are benefiting from a discussion that people that might see this, if it were just shown in a museum, you know, 10, 15, 20 years from now, would not mm-hmm. have the benefit of this kind of conversation. In the past, on occasion, you have been accused of, you know, the work is too opaque, or that you would need too much information to be able to interpret it. So, I mean, again, having time now to reflect back on moments in which, you know, those accusations have been made, you answer that now?
I used to get that question quite often. It's like, how in the world do you expect anybody to understand all of the references you've deployed in an artwork? And my response would be, well, I don't, because I don't think that that's the way an artwork functions. And so, again, you know, in invoking Chantal Ackerman, at one moment she said that in an attempt to address the most, the largest audience she can, she tries to make her work as particular as possible to her subjective position. So it's not about trying to reach the lowest common denominator, but if she can find a way to give form to the very particular quality of her subjectivity, that will actually allow someone to perceive it and stand in relationship to it in the film, in the film works that she makes. As a response to this query about, you know, how do you expect anyone to understand all the references? I made an artwork, because isn't that what artists do? Sometimes, you know, like, there's a problem, and so you attempt to address it and make an artwork that might respond to that. And I made a work in, I think it was 2000, and it was shown at the Frankfurter Kunstverein. And it's kind of complicated to describe. It's like a room was built, but the component that I'm talking about is that there, I went to the Theodor Adorno archive, which is in Frankfurt. And this was another kind of survey show, so there were many works of mine. And I got photocopies of the original carbon manuscript of the fetish character of music, or the regression in listening, that had been written by Adorno as a response to Walter Benjamin's essay, The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction. And I had these texts photocopied on letterhead stationery from the Frankfurter Kunstverein. And then they had a stamp from the Theodor Adorno archive on them. And then I alternated between letterhead stationery and fluorescent yellow stationery. And then they were all laminated in thick plastic, and they were in one of those accordion metal sorting files. So people could walk into this room, and they could pick them up and read them. People. I couldn't read them, because I can barely speak and read English. All the stuff was in German, so I had made an artwork kind of in an overdetermined way as a work for and of Frankfurt. But anyone, almost anyone walking in off the street would be able to read that text that was denied me. I was denied access to it. So I wanted to, so it's not about me even understanding all the references or deploying all of that, because no artwork, no artist ever understands all the components of the work. I don't care what they say.
Are there any other questions? We're getting pretty late, so. One more from Jean, yes. Sorry.
Could you say something about the title Vinyl 2 in relation to Warhol's Vinyl?
Mm-hmm.
And the drone and love song?
Yes. Yeah. With the title Vinyl 2, and yes, I was thinking about Vinyl by Warhol, and thinking that he was absolutely ingenious in the most concise manner in that film, where at one moment, off camera, someone puts a 45 record on, and Gerard Malanga dances for the length of it. And it's about 3 minutes, because it's a 45, you know, it's a hit song. And then after that, there's a very little hesitation, and the person puts the record on again. And Malanga starts to dance again. And I guess the drugs kicked in, because then he really had a field day dancing to it. But I thought, there's no literal cut. I mean, I'm sure that there are many terms for this, but I've always thought of that as being a vertical cut. So it's not like making the lateral cut by cutting the film and splicing it together, but while the camera was rolling, something happened that made a division, a structural division. And I thought, I'd like to do that. And tonight we had the funny experience that, you know, we had like the lightning show, and that wasn't part of it. But, you know, when you do things in the world, you expect surprises. But I think that you mentioned something to me earlier today, Gesundheit, that when the camera moves into that transition threshold from one room to the next, that it was as though a painting was made. And I love that, because that's how I see that, that there aren't the images of two paintings bookending that film. It's not the Van Honthorst and the Georges de la Tour, but there's my monochrome painting in the middle. And that's part of, you know, my history of making. And at that moment, so much of the material density of the Getty and everything that you've seen has been renegotiated out of the frame, and you focus upon this out-of-focus wood grain. And then at one moment, you realize that something's changed, and the wood grain comes into focus. And of course, what happens there is that there's a cut. We do a cross dissolve. We change the lens. We change all sorts of things there to move into that next room. And then, yes, for me in music, there are only two things that exist: love songs and dramas. And then I said something about pop songs about love, sex, and death, which I know is redundant because all pop songs are about love, sex, and death. And so I've thought about the power of a pop song because it's unassuming. And so you start to hum along, and, well, you know, at the moment that you're humming along with the song in vinyl 2, you're basically singing along to an unrequited love letter.
What were you singing? What were the lyrics in vinyl 2?
It starts as, I wrote the lyrics, and some of them are in response to some art historical records I had read of Jerusalem Latour, but I really wrote a whole cloth in that way. But the first stanza is a description of the Georges de Latour painting that you haven't seen yet in the film, and you will see at the very end. And that was part of that accompanied the invitation, you know, like, come deconstruct our museum, here are all these catalogs, here's our collection. And I was flipping through, and I saw that they owned a Georges de Latour painting. And when I was a kid, I was wild for Georges de Latour. And then later, I was crushed when, you know, Susan Sontag referred to him as camp. And I thought, no, Georges de Latour couldn't be camp. This was in my serious period. But so I ran up to the Getty to see what their Georges de Latour was, and I was disappointed because it's an early painting and it doesn't have any of the tenebrist qualities that had really got me going when I was a kid. So it wasn't dark, and it didn't have the candle flame, and it didn't have the hand in front of the candle, all of that kind of Caravaggio-esque crap. And then, so that film is based upon a momentary disappointment. And I think but you know, what could be better? The painting that they own is The Musician's Brawl, and it's about deception. Like, does the hurdy-gurdy player, is he really blind, or is he just faking it to make money on the corner? And lemon juice is being squeezed into his eyes to verify whether he's blind or not. And of course, you know, it's The Musician's Brawl, it's not The Musician's Concert. So there are all these instruments there, not one of them is being played, because they're involved with the different, you know, different societal matters at that moment. So the first verse describes the painting. Then I say, say that there are things missing, like where's this wisp of smoke? Where's this? Where's that? Where's it? And then it shifts into direct address of Georges, and it turns into a letter. Dear, you know, what's wrong, Georges? It's impossible. And then the last verse goes into a much more kind of metaphysical area. Like, where is the head? Like, what is the relationship to the body and the mind, basically? So it leaves the concrete details of these paintings, or even the world, or this museum turned into a production site, and asks these other kinds of questions that are either productive or stereotypical. I can't decide. I can't.
Could you tell us the name of Goff's cat?
I've seen a photo of it, but I don't remember the name.
It was called Chiaroscuro.
That's right. See, it all comes together in the end.
Okay, I don't really want to kill this kind of metaphysical almost atmosphere that you created now, but I did want to ask you again whether you truly believe that institutional critique is obsolete. and whether you're actually referring just to a particular moment or its particular manifestations, that rather than thinking that, maybe thinking that it actually has liberated a lot of practices into what they are now.
Well, I agree with the latter. I attempted to refer more to the reception of it, where people say, oh yeah, we know institutional critique, we know how that operates, and I think that it's still a very viable territory, depending upon how it's engaged. So, yeah, I was talking more about, I mean, Stuart and I have had a discussion about this, but people would say, oh yeah, that institutional critique stuff, isn't that from the late 80s, early 90s? We moved on to something else now, that had kind of run its course. And I'm thinking, well, I would just ask the question, well, has it? Because I guess I never think that anything runs its course and nothing has been removed from the menu. I mean, there are certain moments when certain ways of working or certain approaches are perhaps more fertilely suggestive than others to artists or even a larger group of artists, but I don't agree that anything is ever taken off the menu. And if it's thought to be off the menu, that's the first thing that I want to order.
Okay, on that note, it's late, so I really want to thank all of you for coming, and thanks very much to Stephen Prino for these fantastic.
Thank you, Stuart. Thank you very much.